Hey everybody, I'm Garrett.
And I'm Melissa.
We've been married for 8 years and have two kids, Caleb and Sadie.
Over the last few years, we have fallen in love with the scriptures and are learning how digging into God's word has helped us grow deeper with each other and those around us.
We want to be real about our lives, our struggles, and our joys.
This is Growing Deeper.
Hey guys, before we get to the podcast, just want to remind you to rate and review the podcast. That'll make sure that if somebody looks up Exodus or Ruth, that they will be able to pull up our podcast and see what we have to say on different sections of the Bible. Also, if you have any questions or comments or things that you want to share with us, you can email us now. We now have an email address of growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. That's growingdeeperpodcast@gmail.com. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you, even just saying, hey, we're listening and really appreciate it or something like that. I don't know. Shoot us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Now on to the podcast.
Hey everyone, we are back and we are just slowly approaching 25% of Exodus. ever so slowly, just inching along through Exodus. But I hope you've enjoyed this study so far. I know I've enjoyed it a lot more than I expected to for some reason. I think I could probably say that of all the books that we've studied so far.
I'd say the plagues was probably the thing that I was most concerned about how it would go, and it's gone really well.
Yeah, and what's funny is we read through like the first few plagues, and I was like, well, that was really fun. like which sounds kind of crazy, but
it's so fun to watch plagues come down on people.
But yeah, so yeah, I mean, I've really enjoyed reading this with like, my adult eyes, I guess.
And fresh eyes, or just really just maybe eyes that you've never actually sat down and read it before.
Yeah.
So it really is brand new eyes.
Yeah.
That you're looking at it with.
Yeah. So before we jump into chapter 10.
Yes.
25%. Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to have a little story time, a little time to reflect on this past week, specifically today. Well, and yesterday, I guess. So today was Caleb's first day back to preschool, and being the good mother that I am, I purchased a Caleb's first day of preschool sign. really, it's like the only crafty, well, I won't even call it crafty. It's like, I am not a Pinterest mom kind of deal. I'm really bad at coming up with ideas. So this is like the one thing that I feel like, okay, this is like the picture that I'm supposed to have that I'm actually doing.
Right. This is what every mom is supposed to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So there's like on the sign, there's like a few prompts. And if you flip over the sign, it has a last day of school thing too. So anyway, the first day of school asks what Caleb, like, what do you like to do? So it's the prompt is, I like to, and Caleb tells me, eat cupcakes, which is funny that his first thing that pops into his mind is eating cupcakes. I'm assuming that's because it was just Sadie's birthday.
Right.
And he's had cupcakes a lot recently, I guess, just with having
pretty much
cupcakes
he's
leftover
just been
cupcakes.
Eating a lot of sweets recently.
Yeah.
And we haven't really controlled it well. And
but now
he did
we're back
have,
into our routine.
Yeah, heavy
hopefully.
Cupcakes.
Yeah, then he was like, get toys, watch movies, and finally he redeemed himself with playing outside. So that was fun. And then this is the one that really got to me. There's a prompt that says, I want to be. And so when I told him that prompt, he said, a skeleton. And I was like, buddy, no. Like, I'm not writing.
You know, I wonder if that comes from the Coco movie.
Maybe so. I don't see, ever since last Halloween, so almost a year, he's been like really into, he's just very intrigued by like creepy or scary things. So like for his last day of school, which we like randomly did in June, like because of COVID, and he didn't really have like an official last day. It was just like all of a sudden, oh, we're not going back kind of thing. But he had said he wanted to be a super scary mummy. And I did write that on the board then, but I was like, not again, son. Not again.
So we said, kid, you got to revise from the skeleton.
I said, no, this question is really asking, what do you want to be when you grow up? Like, do you want to be an astronaut or a doctor or a nurse or an engineer or whatever? And so finally he comes up, he just says, ambulance. And I was like, what? And he's like, you know, someone who drives an ambulance. And so I was like, okay, someone who drives an ambulance is going on the board. And I don't know where that came from.
Yeah, I don't know either.
But it was really funny. And so, yeah, his little four-year-old sign says he wants to be someone who drives an ambulance. I think last year it was a superhero. He's gotten less and a little bit less into superheroes.
Yeah, once I decorated his whole room with superhero stuff, he was like, you know, I may be more interested in Pokemon now.
And Mario.
Or Mario.
Sonic the Hedgehog.
So I spent loads of money on decorating his bedroom with Spider-Man.
His room is awesome if you love Marvel.
I love it. I love his room. I wish I had his room.
Yeah.
And now that I've got it good and decorated, he's like, I like Pikachu.
I mean, he still likes Spider-Man and stuff, but it's not the same level as it used to be.
No, definitely not.
Which I was thinking for a while, he might be Spider-Man every Halloween until he's like 10. Like, right. I just didn't.
I was actually kind of hoping it would be that way. That he would just, that would be his nerd thing.
Well,
to be Spider-Man.
He still loves it. He still, you know, mentions it and everything. But anyways, just thought that was funny. It was really nice for him to go back to school today, and he got to do soccer this evening, and so it was just nice to kind of be back into some things that feel normal.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we don't have any setbacks with those, because we really enjoyed that today.
Yeah. I agree.
So before we jump into reading chapter 10 of Exodus, over the past week or so we've kind of thought a lot about this idea of hardening your heart. God hardening.
Yeah. Well, really,
Pharaoh's heart.
I got new books for my birthday, and one of those is a book called Exodus Old and New, which is written by a guy, Michael Morales, who's really well known for another book that he wrote called Who Shall Ascend the Mountain of the Lord. And I'm really looking forward. I got that book too, and I'm super excited about that. It's all revolving around the book of Exodus and what is Exodus doing? Why is it important? We tend to skip over it.
Just a little thought here is, you know, just to emphasize how much he loves these books. Tonight at soccer, it started raining in the middle of the practice, so they just had to call. It was like all of a sudden it just started downpouring. And I get up with Sadie and Caleb's on the soccer field, and I turn around, and Garrett has his book underneath his, tucked under his shirt, and running for the car.
I left my family behind, and I said, I will protect my book, and it will make it to the car before anybody else is saved.
It's like, I'll be back, maybe.
If it was a deluge like Noah, the book is the first thing to be saved.
Literally left.
And then you can bring the family on board.
I think he carried a chair with him, but to me that just felt like a ruse, no, I was carrying a chair back to the car. That's why I left you with the kids. It had nothing to do with the book. Yeah, the book is completely dry, but that had nothing to do with it.
I did protect the book, though.
Anyways, go on.
It is dry, and I did, it's in good shape. I hate it whenever books have people put like earmarks in them, or I hate mistreated books. It makes me so sad.
Books have feelings too.
They do. And so I take care of books. Kids can handle rain, books cannot. So I did protect my book. That was the first order of business whenever it just started downpouring on us. The kids were going to be fine.
Yeah.
And so were you. The book was not going to be. So I protected the most vulnerable.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What a hero.
Yeah. So seek justice, love mercy, walk humbly. That's taking care of those that are not able to take care of themselves. A book cannot take care of itself in the rain.
Wow.
So I took care of it for it.
Justifying actions.
It makes complete sense. Anyways, so I've gotten this new book, and he, in his book, whenever he goes through and he's translating some of these verses that are talking about Pharaoh's heart being hardened, I noticed that he had something a little bit different. Because we've been studying it, I noticed whenever something was different. Mm-hmm. And the difference was that he translated as strengthened. And I thought that was really curious. And I was like, why is he choosing to translate it this way? And he even makes the point in his book. He's like, I want to be careful that we don't just try to get away from something just because it's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So we want to be careful that whenever we're trying to grasp with this stuff, that we're not just changing a meaning of something just because we think it's uncomfortable. So right. that's I think that's step one with mm-hmm. this hardening of heart. We want to make sure that whenever we're approaching the text, that we're not just saying, well, I don't like the word harden, so I'm just going to change it. And I'm going to assume it means something different. And so we just need to be careful with that, because then we are reading ourselves into the text and saying, well, that's not a God that I'm comfortable with, so I'm just going to deny it and pretend that it's something else.
Yeah.
And it's meant to challenge us, and we're supposed to grapple with it. But with this one, I do think this is something that people struggle with, and I think it we owe it to the text, and we owe it to ourselves to wrestle with it a little bit. And so I noticed whenever he was translating these things that he was translating to strength, and I was like, I wonder what that's about. And it occurred to me, I've never, you know, I've been reading these scholars' opinions and things on these, and a lot of times they just say, hey, you know, we don't need to defend the Bible. We let the Bible speak for itself. And I agree with that. However, I was kind of taking a lot of what they were saying and just letting, you know, kind of regurgitating it. But I never really, I have the ability to do word studies on my own. Why haven't I done that yet? Mm-hmm. And so it kind of occurred to me that I hadn't done that for these words. Whenever, if I was just studying it without all of those sources, I would have done a word study. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to quickly, just briefly, get into this of just to give you the capabilities of doing it, or you can do this kind of stuff through app called Blue Letter Bible has the capability to do this. I do this through the Logos software that I have on my computer, but you can go do this yourself. But what I did was I've gone through these sections for the where it gets translated in the NIV. It's consistently that Pharaoh's heart was strengthened or was hardened, or that, you know, Yahweh or the Lord hardened his heart. But what I noticed in my translations is that there's a difference, that from one, it goes from, and his heart was hardened, or Yahweh hardened his heart. And then there's another version, in the story that it says it made his heart insensitive. So I was like, what's that about? And come to realize in doing word studies, there's actually two words that are used for this. And NIV, you'll never see it. You'll never notice it because it's always hardened. But they're two totally different Hebrew words. So I'll give an example before we get into chapter 10. One of them shows up in chapter 10, verse 1. Go to Pharaoh, for I have made his heart insensitive. And the NIV, you'll read, I've hardened his heart. Mm-hmm. And the heart of his servants in order to put these signs of mine in his midst. Okay, so that word, insensitive, or the hardened word there, is the word kavod. It's a word that's used all throughout the Hebrew Bible. But there's 113 instances of it. But it means to make it heavy, to weigh heavily on. The main way that this is translated in the Hebrew Bible is honor. To give something honor, you give it kavod. If it has honor, it's kavod. It's heavy. Or the next way is it's heavy. The one beyond that is glorified, or glory. That makes up for over 50% of the translations. That right there. That word, either this word kavod that occurs in verse 1, is usually translated as honored or made honorable, heavy, or glorified. Okay? So, or even whenever you talk about Yahweh's glory, it's his kavod. So I think, you know, that's kind of step one here. And I think that whenever I start hearing it that way, I start realizing it's like, okay, So maybe this is a pride thing. Like he's allowing him to feel, I have made his heart heavy, given it weight. Maybe there's something there more than just hardened heart. Even though that's kind of the common translation. Okay, so the second word that gets used is at the end of chapter 10. And this one, it says, let me see here. In verse 27, and Yahweh hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he was not willing to release them. So this is the word that he translated in the book that I was reading as the word strengthened. So I was like, what's that about? What we counted it, it was 46% of the time in the Hebrew Bible, this word, it is the Hebrew word, hazik. I probably butchered that, but it's yahazik. But 46% of the time in the Hebrew Bible, it's translated as repaired to bring, like, so for instance, repaired is used in like Ezra and Nehemiah whenever they're rebuilding the walls. They yahizik the walls. That's actually the way it's translated most of the time is repaired. The next one is strengthened to reinforce, basically. Again, repaired, reinforced. You're thinking about walls. The walls are going back up. Or to be made strong. Okay? So, I think that kind of changes the way that I view this word. And Yahweh, this is 46% of the time, it's repaired, strengthened, or made strong, to be made strong. The most famous instance, I think, of this, this word hezek is used in the verse that says, tells Joshua, be strong and courageous, right? That's the same word that's being used there. He's saying, be strong. You know, build up your courage, and prepare yourself for this battle, this thing that's going to happen, because I'm going to go with you. And he's telling himself to build up his courage.
Mm-hmm.
Or for instance, it's used whenever David is hiding from Saul and Jonathan goes out to him. It says that he hezeks him. He strengthens him, that Jonathan hezeks David, so that he can have the strength to the continuing willpower to do what he needs to do with Saul and to keep moving as opposed to just continuing to be in hiding.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way that it's used, and it made me think for this specifically for this word. It's almost like I've been running a lot, but let's say that I wanted in my mind. In my mind, I wanted to go run a marathon, but I've never physically built up my strength and endurance to go run a marathon. You know, I'm only at 13 miles right now,
mm-hmm.
but I haven't built up the endurance to go do a marathon right now. But let's say I get to that 13 and I'm like, my body is quitting. And then it's like my whole body is shut down because it wasn't prepared to do the 26, and that God hezeks me and gives me courage to keep going. And it's like you're getting more willpower to go the next mile,
mm-hmm.
and then you're given hezek even more to go the next mile. And so it's like something that you weren't really prepared to do, somehow you're doing it.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what's happening. I just want to throw that out there. I think that may be what's happening here, is that it's almost like every time this happens, whenever it says that Yahweh hardened his heart, or he hezeks his heart, yahezeks his heart, it seems like Pharaoh is just about to give up, but Yahweh gives him courage to continue. Not that he's telling him, like he's saying, giving him a different disposition. Like, again, my mind wanted to go 26 miles,
mm-hmm.
but my body wasn't capable of it. Pharaoh's body's not capable of it. His mind wants to keep going and fighting Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's like, he's shutting down, and Yahweh's like giving him the strength to keep doing what he's already dispositioned to do.
So some things you've been saying have kind of made me have this thought of like, sort of like, fortifying your heart and having maybe this wall, if you kind of think of your heart as a place and having a wall around your heart that doesn't let anything new in,
mm-hmm.
or doesn't let anything that's already in it out.
Mm-hmm.
So if he already has this like disposition of firmness against, you know, letting the people go, then nothing that happens is going to be able to like penetrate his heart, because mm-hmm. it's like, it's getting firmer. It's getting, his heart's getting stronger to keep those, you know, outside sources out.
Yeah.
Or, you know, keep them from getting in.
Right. Yeah. And so he rebuilds the walls of his heart. And you know, and I don't know that that solves the problem. You know, I don't know that that solves our cultural problem with yeah. maybe this verse. I think it maybe can help us understand it a little bit more. And this isn't by any means like a full on scale word study
mm-hmm.
that we're doing, but I think it is really important for us to see how it's used. This is the only place in the Hebrew Bible that this word is used or is translated as hardened. Why is it? And I guess I'm kind of frustrated with that a little bit. Like, why is it that the same word is translated different ways in Exodus, that it's hardened, but everywhere else it doesn't appear as hardened? It appears as strengthened, or it appears as to be made strong, or to repair, to it's always that, or grasp, like even those types of words. But like only here, only in the Exodus, and only in a verse that's talking about the Exodus, does it use the word, do we translate it as the word hardened? So you just don't, you won't ever notice it. So mm-hmm. even whenever you're reading a prophet, for instance, who's actually referencing the Exodus, you wouldn't pick up on it because it's not translated the same way.
Yeah.
And so we're at a real disadvantage with that, especially whenever we're reading a prophet that is trying to get you to think about the Exodus, and they translate it as strengthen your heart instead, or whatever, you know, or that, you know, you made your hearts, you know, strong against him, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That we don't get that reference because of it. And that's a real shame, but we can do it. There's the tools are out there to make that happen. We just got to put extra effort into it to try mm-hmm. To try to reach that point. So I just want to offer those out there. I don't want to say that I've solved the problem. I haven't solved the problem.
Just bringing some more information.
Just bringing more information for you guys to ponder over, to think about, what does this really mean? What does it mean for Yahweh to harden Pharaoh's heart?
Just to at least consider this word outside of just reading hardened as like an American that speaks English, you know? Like,
yeah.
Just kind of thinking about it beyond of what this would truly mean to maybe the people of this time.
Yeah, and even Judges 3:12, and again the Israelites did evil in the eyes of Yahweh, so Yahweh strengthened Eglon king of Moab against Israel because they did evil in the eyes of Yahweh. So whenever even this is a pagan king that is, I mean, he's with Moab, they're their enemies, you know. And it's like whenever that word is used for Eglon, they translate it as strengthened. And so, again, why do we do that? How does it change how we view it if we say, and Yahweh strengthened Pharaoh's heart? It's he gives him like more strength to do what his already will and disposition was to do.
Yeah,
I think that's consistently the place that I keep coming back to, is there is, you know, every scholar that I read, and even this, in looking at the word this way, it's not that Yahweh is changing his already preconceived dispositions. It's like he's giving him the ability to continue, even whenever he doesn't. Like, he truly doesn't have the physical strength to do it. Yahweh gives him the physical strength to do what his heart already wants.
Yeah.
And so that's where we are. And I think that's at least part of what's going on. So with that, we're going to pick up with chapter 10 and go through these last two plagues of the set of nine, the set of nine that's leading up to the climax. That's the 10th plague. last time we got the hail, whenever it comes down, and you see like this grace that's provided to the Egyptians, and how they're even allowed to participate in, or at least given grace so that they can pull all their stuff in, and even that stuff is left over, not everything is gone. But the hail is coming, you know, down and striking everything and destroying everything. And, but still we ended in 35 and Pharaoh's heart was hard and he did not release the Israelites. Again, that's that Yahazik or Yahazak, that, he made his heart hard. So we're going to pick up in chapter 10, verse 1. This is going to be a little bit long one, but this is all one plague right here. So
go ahead. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the hearts of his officials so that I may perform these miraculous signs of mine among them, that you may tell your children and grandchildren how I dealt harshly with the Egyptians and how I perform my signs among them, and that you may know that I am the Lord." So Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said to him, "This is what the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, says. How long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Let my people go so that they may worship me. If you refuse to let them go, I will bring locusts into your country tomorrow. They will cover the face of the ground so that it cannot be seen. They will devour what little you have left after the hail, including every tree that is growing in your fields. They will fill your houses and those of all your officials and all the Egyptians, something neither of your fathers nor your forefathers have ever seen from the day they settled in this land till now." Then Moses turned and left Pharaoh. Pharaoh's officials said to him, "How long will this man be a snare to us? Let the people go so that they may worship the Lord their God. Do you not yet realize that Egypt is ruined?" Then Moses and Aaron were brought back to Pharaoh. "Go, worship the Lord your God," he said. "But just who will be going?" Moses answered, "We will go with our young and old, with our sons and daughters, and with our flocks and herds, because we are to celebrate a festival to the Lord." Pharaoh said, "The Lord be with you, if I let you go, along with your women and children. Clearly you are bent on evil. No, have only the men go, and worship the Lord, since that is what you have been asking for." Then Moses and Aaron were driven out of Pharaoh's presence. And the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over Egypt so that locusts will swarm over the land and devour everything growing in the fields, everything left by the hail." So Moses stretched out his staff over Egypt, and the Lord made an east wind blow across the land all that day and all that night. By the morning, the wind had brought the locusts. They invaded all Egypt and settled down in every area of the country in great numbers. Never before had there been such a plague of locusts, nor will there ever be again. They covered all the ground until it was black. They devoured all that was left after the hail, everything growing in the fields and the fruit on the trees. Nothing green remained on tree or plant in all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh quickly summoned Moses and Aaron and said, "I have sinned against the Lord your God and against you. Now forgive my sin once more and pray to the Lord your God to take this deadly plague away from me." Moses then left Pharaoh and prayed to the Lord, and the Lord changed the wind to a very strong west wind, which caught up the locusts and carried them into the Red Sea. Not a locust was left anywhere in Egypt, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let the Israelites go.
Okay, so at the beginning of this, we do get a glimpse as to why is Yahweh allowing this to continue? Why doesn't he, like he said in the hailstorm, mm-hmm. right before the hailstorm, why doesn't he just destroy them?
Yeah.
Why doesn't he just wipe them from the earth and then just have basically Israel just take over the place?
Yeah.
And the point is that it seems to be, in what he says, so that you will tell in the ears of your children, you know, in the ears of your child and your grandchild, that I dealt harshly with the Egyptians, and so that you will tell about my signs that I have done among them, and so that you will know that I am Yahweh. So the reason that he's giving this weighty heart of Pharaoh, the reason he's doing that, and allowing Pharaoh to continue to kind of fight back against him, is so that his wonders can be intensified so that Israel knows who Yahweh is, so that you will know. Again, that keeps coming up, so that you will know. That's what this whole thing is about, mm-hmm. is so that they come to know Yahweh, both Israel and Egypt. And so this is recapitulating that theme of that, so that you're going to carry this on, and not just you, but your children and your grandchildren and everybody that comes after you. Even now, think about it. What are we doing right now? We are doing exactly what this text is talking about, so that we will know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're coming to know Yahweh because of what happened here.
Yeah.
And so we're fulfilling this, really, in its reading.
And I think what's interesting here is that it was in this section that I first had this realize, you know what, during all this time, God has not seemed like an irrational, angry God.
Mm-hmm.
He has seemed calm and patient. He's been lied to. He has forgiven and provided grace. I think on the surface, if you think about all these plagues, you're like, wow, he's mad at someone. But then at the same time, when I think of how we try to deal with Caleb and eventually Sadie, with consequences, you know, we try to stay calm. We don't always stay calm, but usually things go better when we stay calm and say, look, this is a consequence of this behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why we are, you know, taking away X or sending you to timeout or whatever. And I kind of feel like that's just what's happening here. And obviously these seem very extreme, but also the actions of Pharaoh have and the prior pharaohs have been extreme.
Yeah. And just like every other things that we've talked about, even in the minor prophets, it's that God's judgment isn't for the sake of judgment. He's not saying, I'm going to do all this to you just because I just want to do it to you.
Mm-hmm.
The whole point is so that they come to know who he is.
Yeah.
And that's no different than what we do with our kids. We're trying to teach them something. We're trying to let them, remind them who's boss in here.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're not going to run over us.
Yeah.
And then the goal, the real end goal, isn't really that they just know who's boss. It's so that we can... You know, we raise up kids that are good human beings
that and love other people, respect other people.
And so we do all that. We send out our judgment on them, if you want to put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And all our signs and wonders, where we take things away and in his mind, we destroy his stuff. But it's like, no, we just took it away, kid.
Yeah,
and we'll give it back. But we're trying to remind you that these blessings come from us.
Yeah.
And then ultimately we're also trying to show him that all of our blessings come from God, and that, so we're trying to show him that. And so it's not just for the sake of judgment that we're doing it. There's a purpose behind it.
Yeah.
The judgment is trying to bring something more out of it. And I think that's what's happening here. There's more to it than just the judgment. The plagues are a grace. That he doesn't just destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
In and of themselves, they are grace. Although it makes their lives very painful, it is for a purpose, which is so that they may know him and come to know who I am Yahweh, to quote it.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the purpose.
Yeah. I just think it's interesting. It's like, I think we read, you know, that God dealt harshly with the Egyptians and think, oh, well, he must hate them or something. It's like, no, like, we deal harshly with our children sometimes because it's necessary,
mm-hmm.
and we love them immensely. So like, harshly doesn't mean that he was angry and hated these people.
No. And I think even more so, it's talking about, I mean, think about reading this in a exile standpoint, mm-hmm. where you are being oppressed by people. That you've got Jewish readers in exile in Babylon that are under the thumb of Babylon.
Yeah.
And Egypt is easily the best representation of Babylon in their scriptures. And just like he dealt harshly with Egypt, who is an oppressive nation, sending these people into slavery, you know, and driving them hard in the dust, not giving them any rest, and instead calling them lazy. Whenever they're being ground out and their lives are made bitter with brick and mortar, that it's giving them hope in that God's not going to put up with oppressive nations for forever. Mm-hmm. There is going to be judgment. There is going to be a dealing with harshly, although the whole point isn't just to deal harshly. So it's this, there is a tension, you know, he can't just be, you know, like letting things go on forever. He wouldn't be a good God then. We've talked about this in the prophets. I mean, I think this is a recurring theme throughout scripture that we have to wrestle with. It's like, if we really believe that God is good, then he's going to do things about oppressive nations and countries that mm-hmm. are hurting people.
Yeah.
And he's not going to put up with that forever. And we also have to be reflective of that on our own to say, you know, he's not going to put up with me being this way forever. And it's not that he won't relent if you turn. I mean, that's what happens in this story. You know, he cries out to the intercessor, and then, and we'll get into that a little bit, but he cries out to the intercessor and he relents.
Mm-hmm.
The intercessor goes before God and he relents for Pharaoh. Now, does Pharaoh experience a real change of heart? No. But that's kind of the story of the Bible. That's exactly what, like, something's got to happen that changes our heart.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it so that we actually can respond to God. Anyways, so I want to keep going through the actual scripture here.
I think it's cool in verse 2 mentioning the children and grandchildren. To me, that's just a reminder of God's promise to the people. Mm-hmm. Just kind of wanted to point that out of he still has that promise in the back of his mind. So we've got this next section of just like Aaron and Moses going to Pharaoh, which at this point, you know, Aaron just feels like the hiking dog, you know, that's just like tagging along with Moses.
Yeah, he's totally faded into the background.
For the, you know, hanging out with Moses as his little buddy. But so he's telling Pharaoh about the locusts, and this is kind of where we reflect back to chapter 9 of just like, yeah, all the things that the hail didn't destroy, they're going to be destroyed now with the locust.
Mm-hmm.
So we did have kind of that moment of grace of giving more time and an opportunity to change hearts. And that's kind of what we're seeing here is like, okay, now this is it. The rest of it's gone if you don't let the people go.
And I think verse 4 kind of goes back to that. I don't think that Pharaoh was unable to change his decisions, you know, even with his hardened heart, even mm-hmm. with that strengthened heart. But if you are refusing to release my people, look, you know, or he says, until when will you refuse to submit before me, please release my people so that they may serve me. But if you are refusing to release my people, look, I am going to bring locust into your territory tomorrow. I think that there is agency in this, in that he has the ability to choose something different. But now that his heart is strengthened, he's going to continue down his predisposed dispositions. And we've also found that whenever he does break down and realize how bad he is, he just turns right back around and does the same thing again.
Yeah.
But
we also see that, like, to build on that point of the Pharaoh's officials, their hearts were also hardened.
Yes.
And yet we see, as we move along into verse 7, that they're like questioning, like, man, maybe we should just, like, Pharaoh, maybe we should just let these people go.
Yes.
Now they're not coming, you know, I think they're coming at this from a place of like, finally asking the question, we've already seen what are we on? We've seen seven plagues. This is the eighth.
Yes.
The locusts are the eighth. So it's like, what makes us think that if we don't, like, that this is ever going to stop?
Yes.
Like, you know, we know the rest of the story. We know exactly how many there are. But they don't know, like, when this is, like, how this is going to evolve.
Yeah.
So it's like, finally hey, you know, I'm not saying they're coming from a good place of, like, the right thing to do is to let the people go. I think it's more out of protection for themselves.
No, but even still, I think the point here is to be made that the servants of Pharaoh, their heart was made heavy,
mm-hmm.
and yet they were able to see the wisdom in, let's stop pestering this God and let them go on their way.
Yeah.
Because Egypt is destroyed. So they're able to see it, even though their hearts are made heavy. But somehow Pharaoh isn't able to, again, it's, I don't think it's God keeping him from making a change in decision. He's giving him the ability, he's still allowing him to be able to change his decision, but Pharaoh still thinks he's holding the cards for some reason. You know, it's like, it's almost like he's making you think he's got a decent hand. And he doesn't, you know, that God's actually the one holding all the cards. And so again, I think that is a really good point in thinking about what does it mean for it? Well, it can't mean that they can't change their mind, because they very much do in verse 7, and they're trying to get him to see reason. And they can't, and he can't see it. He won't see it.
And I also, as we're moving through here, just thinking about another question that I'm surprised has taken this long to be asked is, but who will be going with you? We've seen other times where Pharaoh has said, okay, you can worship your God, but do it in Egypt. Or you can worship your God, but stay really close. And never before has he asked who would be involved with that. And, you know, Moses is saying, well, we're going to take, you know, everyone, men, women, children, you know, elderly.
Cattle, sheep, goats.
All the things. And I think it's so interesting that Pharaoh's response is like, kind of like, really, it's only important that the men go, in a way. I might be reading a bit into this, but just, you know, this worshiping God, which, you know, that's what they're telling Pharaoh that they're wanting to do, is go for 3 days to worship God. That was something meant for everyone. And men and women
And children and cattle children, and goats and yeah, all of it all was of meant creation. To give praise to God.
And so this wasn't just like an event for the men.
Right.
And that's kind of seems like, well, as maybe a small caveat that Pharaoh thinks maybe I can get away with just saying like just the men go.
Yeah. And I think he is trying to get, he's like, if I let the men go, he thinks that maybe that's all that needs to go.
Yeah.
But I think even the next step is that he knows that if the men go and the women stay and the children stay, the men are going to come back for them.
Yeah.
They're not going to just stay out there. They're not going to leave entirely. I'm not going to lose my whole slave force.
Yeah, it does feel a little bit like he's like, well, you know, what if they just run off?
Yeah. Well, and actually this was a common way that, I think it was pretty normal, in, you know, slavery in America, that, you know, you would like release the man or whatever, but if the women were still here, that they were going to come back. You know, like, it because they cared about their children and their wives. It's like, well, you still had them, and it was, so I mean, it's that's just a people being conniving and able to manipulate a situation. And so I think he's kind of doing that where he's like, okay, I'll give you what you want, but you leave everybody else here, and then I know that you're going to come back. And so whenever Moses says this, that it's going to be everybody, he kind of shows the true intention here, which is not just to go out into the desert and worship for 3 days. That was used to show how stubborn Pharaoh was, that he's never even asked this question before. And now that he's realizing everybody's going to go, he's starting to feel control issues and saying, what if they don't come back?
Maybe suspecting that they're, you know, air quote, up to no good.
Yeah, I would say he knows that they're probably, if they leave, they're not coming back.
So there's so many different layers here. So just take, you know, these are all just kind of thoughts that we had as we studied through this. But another thought that I had was, Garrett recently showed me a video of what the wilderness, looked like.
Yes.
And, it kind of having seen that video and when I was reading this, and it's just like, there's this barren
wasteland,
just kind of had me thinking when I read this, is Pharaoh trying to like, almost cast blame onto Moses, like, oh my goodness, why in the world would you try to take your women and your children and your elderly on this journey out into the wilderness to worship God. Like, it's so dangerous. Like, wow, you should just leave them behind. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe as a means to kind of like reason with Moses to, so that he had some comfort and that they weren't just going to run off.
Yeah. Make him feel like there's, you don't actually have complete control over this situation.
Yeah.
And do you really want to take them out in the desert? And this comes from verse 10 where it says, let Yahweh be thus with you. As soon as I release you from your dependent, you and your dependents, see that evil is before your faces. Or, I think the, you know, I think he says that like, you're being evil or something like that in NIV.
It says, clearly you are bent on evil.
Yes.
And that's Pharaoh talking to Moses. But my Bible also, in the NIV, also has a footnote of, be careful, trouble is in store for you. Yeah. Which, that's what really kind of made me go, is he trying to act like he cares in a sense about like, whoa, it's kind of dangerous out there. Yeah. You really want to take your women and children and elderly out there? That doesn't seem like a good idea. And it reminds me of this scene in Lord of the Rings where like the people are know that they need to flee their land or else they'll be destroyed, and so they go to this place called Helm's Deep. And on that trip, their enemy is saying, yeah, there's going to be women and children with them, which means that they're going to be moving slowly and
they're
like,
going to be vulnerable.
And so it was just kind of like those two things were kind of in my mind of like, you know, taking these vulnerable individuals out into the wilderness here could be a dangerous thing.
Yeah. So in other words, in verse 10, the see the evil is ever before your faces is to say that Moses, if you take everybody out there, Only Ra, that's the word there, only Ra is out there for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, only evil is, a calamity is out there for you. This is the same word that's the tree of knowing Ra, or good, or Tov and Ra,
mm-hmm.
Good and evil. So he's saying only Ra awaits you in the desert, right? But knowing the story, it's actually the opposite is true. It's good that awaits you in the desert. That in the wilderness is where they're going to be formed as a nation and where God's going to bring them into his midst. And that, you know, he's going to dwell with them. That's what's the good that is awaiting them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of it is a ironic thing that he says. He thinks that only Ra is out there in the desert for them and that you're going to die out there. It's not going to be your fault. Mm-hmm. You're going to die out there. But the truth of the matter is it's Egypt, this lush land that's the Ra for them, and it's the wilderness that's the Tov for them, the thing that's actually good for them. And so there's just this irony, I think, that's going on here.
So this, the kind of the response to this, this, I guess, Pharaoh trying to compromise, it's kind of funny to me because there's no like verbal response. It's just like, okay, Moses, stretch out your arm and
yeah.
here come the locusts.
And it's just immediate.
That's going to be a no for me.
Yes.
So I love that where it's just kind of like, I kind of see like somebody kind of tilting their head at him and being like, really? Like, no, that's not going to work. It's all or nothing here.
Yeah. And so he stretches out his staff and it says that Yahweh drove an east wind. It's the east ruach. It's the same word that's used for the spirit. So the spirit of the Lord hovered over, you know, the waters in Genesis chapter 1. This is an east ruach that comes and blows over the land and, you know, it brings all these locusts in and they start eating and destroying everything that was left over from the hail. And I think this is it's just a really cool like scene of what Yahweh's doing. It's like he's just blowing his breath across it and mm-hmm. the locusts come in and destroy everything. And it says that and it covered the surface of all the land and the land was dark with them. And so you kind of see the swarm come in and all the land becomes dark, the way that Joel would talk about it, and that it's like the sun and the moon grow dark.
Mm-hmm.
Because this locust swarm comes in, it just covers up everything. And so the land grows dark. And then as we think about what the next plague is the plague of darkness. This is highlighting and making you think about, this decreative act of like the locust coming in, destroying everything that's green. And so think back to Genesis chapter 1 and all of the Eden imagery in chapter 2, and then all the lush trees and stuff that are brought up from the land in chapter 1. It's making you think all of this is a decreative act of God. Yeah. That he's destroying, you know, he's allowing all of this to be eaten and everything's growing dark. It's going back into chaos.
And I think it kind of reminded me of Genesis language of like blowing across the land all that day and all that night. Mm-hmm. It just kind of reminds me again of like the same kind of words that, you know, same kind of language from Genesis.
Yes, yes. And so everything starts to be destroyed. And then you see Pharaoh again, now that everything bad happens, he says, I have sinned against Yahweh, your God, and against you. Now forgive me my sins, surely this time, and pray to Yahweh, your God, so that he may remove me from this death. So this, whatever this is, I think that it's really interesting, the idea of he's praying to God to remove this death from him.
Mm-hmm.
And which would be, you know, it's like resurrection language anyways. This removal of the death. And so he goes out and does it. And it says that Yahweh turned a very strong west wind or the sea wind. And it lifted up the locust and thrust them into the Reed Sea, the Yam Suf. And not one locust remained. And I think this is really cool language. Whenever you think about locust in the Bible, locust is often used as a metaphor for big armies. So that's what the way that Joel would talk about, it'd be Babylon. He uses the imagery of locusts to show Babylon coming in and taking them into exile. And so the locusts come in and they settle on the ground, and they rest on the ground. They devour everything and then they go off. And so God just kind of blows them back into the sea. And so I think the imagery here is to make us look forward to what's going to happen to Egypt itself, in that he's going to blow an east wind. And it's going to part the seas, and then he's going to allow the seas to, you know, to fall back in on Egypt and destroy them completely.
Mm-hmm.
And so the locust here is kind of it's a foreshadowing of what's to come at the edge of the sea. I think that there's that imagery there.
So, yeah, this is very interesting, going back to talking about how Moses asks for, you know, confesses his sin. And it's kind of hard to know, like, when I'm reading that out loud, I'm like, what fluctuation should I, like, how should I read that? Because, mm-hmm. I don't believe him. And I don't think Moses believes him. And so I don't know what his tone was if he did a great acting job. I don't think Moses believed him either, because we saw he didn't believe him in the last chapter.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the last chapter. But so this is the really interesting part to me of just like Moses prays anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And prays on Pharaoh's behalf, like with no questions asked. He doesn't even say like some snarky comment again, like, yeah, doesn't say anything to him. He goes and prays. And then the even cooler thing is then God relents when Moses prays. And so Garrett had mentioned earlier of just this idea of like an intercessor, mm-hmm. somebody going on our behalf. And when we were studying this together, it obviously pointed us to Jesus and how sometimes we are not, maybe our heart's not fully in something, but maybe we're at a little different place than Pharaoh, where we want it to be somewhere else. And we have Jesus to kind of intercede for us and to kind of make those prayers on our behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And just how that is just such a cool thing. I don't know. I just find it fascinating.
Yeah, consistently throughout. And this is the way that Moses is going to react or be. He's going to be this person throughout the rest of this book. And it's going to be a consistent theme in the Hebrew Scriptures, where it just seems like there's this need for this righteous intercessor to go before God. And they say, you know, God, remember your covenant, or remember this, or think about that. And they go to Yahweh, and he says, all right, you know, like, okay, I'll forgive them. You know, he just seems consistent in that he does that. Even, and that the first time that's really going to happen for Israel is going to be when at the golden calf. I mean, we're going to see that as we read through the Exodus, that they're going to make a covenant with God. And while Moses is still up on the mountain agreeing to the covenant, they build a golden calf. Mm-hmm. And they violate the covenant before it really ever gets started. They basically have an adulterous relationship, at the wedding ceremony. And Moses goes back down the mountain, talks to them. And he's like, maybe let me go up and see if I can make atonement for you. And so he goes up and he intercedes on their behalf. And he even says, like, hey, if you're not, if you're not willing to forgive them, then blot me out of your book. He's willing to give up his own life for Israel. And when he's up there on the mountain, he's making atonement for them. And he's trying to intercede on their behalf. And Yahweh listens. And that's where we get the description of Yahweh, that he says, Yahweh, Yahweh, gracious, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, full abounding in steadfast love. That's where we get that, is from that moment where it's like Yahweh is being called on by the intercessor to remember the covenant that he made to Abraham, and that's what he does. And he's kind of looking for that. He's kind of egging Moses on, I think, to do that, right? And kind of trying to pull that out of Moses and be like, remember who I am and remember what I'm like, and intercede for them for that. And so there's this righteous intercessor that goes in between. And then that comes to its climax in the person of Jesus. And that's what Hebrews is all about. Hebrews, the book of Hebrews is all about this great high priest that we have in Jesus. And so I think that that's a hugely important theme of this book. It's a hugely important theme of the whole Bible, of this righteous intercessor that goes on behalf of the sinners. So we're gonna keep going here, and we will pick up with verse 21. And Yahweh said to Moses, stretch out your hand towards the heavens, so that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, and so that a person can feel darkness. And Moses stretched out his hands towards the heavens, and there was darkness of night in all the land of Egypt for 3 days. No one could see his brother, and because of it, no one could move from where they were for 3 days, and there was light for the Israelites in their dwellings. And Pharaoh called Moses and said, go, serve Yahweh. Only your sheep and goats and your cattle must be left behind. Your dependents may go with you. And Moses said, even if you yourself put into our hands sacrifices and burnt offerings, and we offer them to Yahweh our God, our livestock must also go with us. Not a hoof can be left, because we must take from them to serve Yahweh our God. And we will not know with what we are to serve Yahweh until we come there. And Yahweh hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he was not willing to release them. And Pharaoh said to him, go from me. Be careful not to see my face again, because on the day you're seeing my face, you will die. And Moses said, that is right. I will not again see your face.
So starting out this section, I was just thinking about the stars that I have seen in places where there's no city lights, there's no house lights or anything, like when we were in, like when we went to Jamaica, or even like when we're at even just like youth retreats, youth mm-hmm. camp stuff, where just the stars are so, you realize how many stars they are, and they kind of provide a source of light for you. Mm-hmm. And so thinking here of like, what if all those were shut out, and covered, and the complete darkness that was actually here, where it's like you can't even see your hand in front of your face.
Yeah, to the point where the scripture says that they could feel the darkness. Think of darkness so thick you can feel it.
Where you couldn't see anyone else or leave where you were. I mean, that's an intent, like you would think your eyes would adjust a little bit or something, yeah.
Did you ever do the sea thing, like the underground sea thing and then they turn out all the lights and you can't see anything. Did you ever do that as a kid?
I don't think so.
Okay. It's pretty intense. I mean, it's yeah. You know, you go down. I can't remember. I mean, it's in Tennessee. You just like up towards Nashville or not Nashville, up towards Knoxville. You pass signs for it all the time. But like this underground sea, you know, quote sea.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
It's just like an underground pond.
I think I've been there.
But you go, pond. You know, you go down in there and they flip out all the lights on you. And you legitimately can't put your hand in front of your face and see anything. That's what we're talking about here, where it's so dark you're legitimately disoriented.
Yeah.
And so, anyways, I'm sorry I interrupted you, but
no, I mean I was just thinking about like how crazy this darkness must be. Because we think of like on the surface you're like like nighttime, but no, mm-hmm. this is like darker than night.
Yeah. And so and it's a. It's a, I think, a stark attack on the Egyptian god of the sun, which is like they're, that's what Pharaoh was believed to be the sun, the S-O-N of the sun god, the S-U-N god. And so it's a deliberate attack on the god who Pharaoh was said to be the son of. And so I think that's kind of why this is right here at the end. There's also other reasons for it. I think it's attacking both like the major deity, but it's also, just like before we were seeing all the land go into darkness,
mm-hmm.
And returning to this chaotic world of this Genesis 1:1, wild and waste darkness. Now we've even revoked. Now God's even revoked his first spoken words of let there be light.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're reverting back to the complete chaos where God is no longer separating light from darkness. Even in the previous, and actually he kind of is. I mean, even in verse 23, it said no one could see their brother, and because of it, no one could even move. But there was light for the Israelites in their dwellings.
Mm-hmm.
So there was light for the Israelites, but for everybody else, it was a return to this chaotic darkness. Everything was returning back to its primordial state. And I think that is very pointed. Every scholar that I read on this is like, this whole thing has creation narrative all throughout it, and mainly decreation narrative, that God is undoing all of the order that he's put into the world. And he's allowing Egypt to experience that, but the Israelites are still experiencing his orderly thing. And I whenever I say that whole but there was light for the Israelites, I hear John and that, you know, he was like, you know, there's light in the darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And that his whole contrast between those two, he's playing on Genesis chapter 1. He's also, I mean, but this is playing on Genesis chapter 1.
Yeah.
And this light in the darkness for the Israelites. Well, who's the light in the darkness for the Israelites? Well, I mean, it's Yahweh is the light in the darkness for the Israelites. Mm-hmm. And just the same, John is saying this person, Jesus, he is the light in the darkness for all of humanity. And that he, you know, these two, this light and dark playing on each other. Is happening all throughout the scriptures, and it's happening right here.
Yeah, and I think we also have to mention this 3 days of that this is the amount of time that the darkness lasted. Because to me, my mind went straight to Jesus's death and resurrection, and how it's kind of like after Jesus died, there's this figurative like darkness
mm-hmm.
for 3 days. Until he resurrects and kind of provides this new hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, this is so Peter would pick up on this with Joel. He would talk about it in his Pentecostal preaching that most people know. He quotes Joel. And he in the section of Joel, it says that, it's talking about the day of the Lord. And it says that the sun and the moon grow dark, you know, and it's like this locust swarm coming in, which we just saw. And even the light, you know, the lights that were set over, the world to govern, the times, even they grow dark. And so this darkness sets in, and Joel and Peter is picking up on that and being like, that happened. That happened whenever Jesus was on the cross. That while he was dying for us, the day of the Lord was being poured out. But it was being poured out in on sin and the flesh of Jesus. But then there's this, it's like this 3-day period, and then this light shines in the darkness. And his resurrection is kind of this new creation moment. It is this new creation moment in that it's, again, it's like the first day, in John's eyes, the way that he writes it, it's so Garden of Eden. Everything in the resurrection story in John's gospel is this Garden of Eden imagery that all of a sudden it's like this new creation has come about. And so, again, this light shines in the darkness after 3 days. That's a theme. There's mm-hmm. a theme going on here. I very much see that tie with Jesus. And I think Peter sees it too. I think that's how he picked, that's what he sees in Joel, you know, that, and then following that, the Spirit of God is poured out on, you know, your sons and your daughters will prophesy, you know, and, the Spirit of God's going to be on everybody. And so that's what he's seeing happening, there.
So as we continue to move through here, you know, Pharaoh decides to make another proposal to Moses of like, okay, you can take all the people, you can take your women, your children, young and old, all the men, whatever, but you got to leave your flocks and your herds behind. And at this point, this is where I really feel like Pharaoh probably for sure knows that, like, they're probably not planning on coming back.
Yeah.
Because I think I would be like, really? You have to take everything. You have no idea what you might need to sacrifice. Like, how do you not know until you get there? Like, yeah. I think I would be having follow-up questions if I were Pharaoh, because it does seem a bit much. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah. Well, this just feels like a real stretch at this point, where he's just kind of grasping for whatever he can. And you just get the sense that Pharaoh has lost all power in this game. And now he's just trying his best to hold on to it. And it's such a feeble attempt. It's like, if everybody's going to leave, Moses is just being like, you have no power here. And I am holding all the cards. Yahweh is with me, and he has dealt all of us out on you, and you're still putting stipulations on this?
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like he's just appeasing him with these words.
Yeah. I mean, the patience of even responding to Pharaoh at this point, I think, with Moses is just like, dude, are you serious right now? But he's even saying, if you were even to give us sacrifices to go out in the desert with us, we're taking our stuff. And you have no ability to say that we can't take our stuff. And this is, it's evident in everything that's happened. When are you going to see it?
Yeah.
And ironically, he's in the darkness. He's not going to see it. But I think that's the kind of thing. He's still blind to all of this. He's still blind to what's going on, thinking he still has power in this situation. He has none. He has absolutely none. And Yahweh has made it evident to everybody except for Pharaoh. Pharaoh's the only one that can't get it. He's the only one that refuses to see it, that he actually has no power, and that he's being used to show Yahweh's power. I think, you know, this situation, Moses has come so far in his faith with Yahweh, and that, you know, these plagues have helped him build that up as they've gone along, to where Moses is even willing to stand in the court and just be like, I'll take what I want to take.
Yeah.
And you really can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
This
also, it feels like a turning point of Pharaoh's last, you know, words to Moses are, you know, get out of my sight, I don't want to see you again. You know, whereas before it's been like, pray for me. You know, like, we just, what do we need to do to make this plague go away? So this is like, definitely, this is something different than what we have seen before in terms of a response out of Pharaoh. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's kind of like, an important note as we, as next time we head into chapter 11, of just kind of, there is some sort of distinction here of kind of like, okay, we're, things are really picking up here.
Yeah.
But just this whole chapter to me, with Pharaoh trying to negotiate or make different proposals, it just, when I read it, I had, and maybe it's just because of everything going on, you know, like we have an election coming up, but it just, it all felt like politics of like when a certain side has a stance and they just don't, I don't care which side we're talking about with politics. It just feels like we've gotten to this point where if your air quote side takes a stance on something, that no matter what, you will just double down on that stance, even if there's things right in front of you that are saying like, you need to change course on this.
Yes.
And so like, even, you know, Pharaoh has his officials with their hardened hearts being like, maybe we should just let him go. And he's just like so set in his position that he just refuses to accept any new thought, to accept any different behavior. And so I just, I think just with where we are with things, I mean, people have stances on COVID that are just unrelenting. People have stances on, you know, whether or not we should have sports that are just unrelenting. I mean, no matter what topic you want to go with, people have opinions about that, those, whatever topic, that are just so firm that, that like nothing you can do will change their mind.
Right.
And that's kind of where we are.
Yeah, and I think that that's meant to, this is meant to challenge us and be like, are we this way? Where all the warning signs are right in front of us and we just refuse to see it. Yeah, because that's where Pharaoh is. He just refuses to see anything different. And, you know, once his willpower is built back up, he just keeps going. And even though he can look back and see like, these aren't wise decisions that I'm making. Once his willpower is built back up, which I think is what that, I think that's what this means, is that he's kind of given, he's strengthened to continue on in his dispositions, pre-established dispositions.
One of those disgusting chocolate pudding packs with caffeine in it for running.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like he's given like a little, little energy packet, little goo packets.
Yeah. Little goo packets to really hold on tight.
Yeah. I don't know. I can't understand why they make those in chocolate. I can't, like, going running and, you know, going 8 miles or something and then wanting to hit a packet of something to help me get more energy. The last thing I want is chocolate or cola. They've got cola flavor. But, yeah, it's like it's a goo packet that he's being given to keep going in his will, that he's given more calories to keep going. But... yeah, once he gets that, he's just like, oh yeah, I'm just gonna keep going, even though this is destroying my body, mm-hmm. You know, even though this is destroying my land, I'm just gonna keep going, and allow it to keep happening. And so we do that. We know certain things are not good for us, and we keep doing it anyways. I talk about that with my you know, I'll check my phone and stuff during the day, and it just like consumes me sometimes of like. Checking Twitter. That's why I had to get rid of my, you know, Twitter, even though I'd still kind of check it occasionally, like even not even having a Twitter account. I think I had you change my password on
it.
I had you change my password on it, and I still find ways to check it.
Be like, and, Tennessee Vols football.
Yeah. And, Twitter. But like, I know that that's not good for me, and yet I still walk upstairs with my phone to go whenever I go work. And I know that that's not something that's good for me. And that's a very menial thing to think about. But that's just one small example that extrapolates into big things that we do all the time that we know aren't good for us. And we kind of harden our heart against it. And we continue down it anyways. And that's what Pharaoh's doing. That's what we're doing. How do we get out of this? You know, how do we get out of this? And again, there is a scriptural theme with this heart issue. Pharaoh has a hard heart. Moses talks about Israel having a hard heart. They have an uncircumcised heart. Jeremiah is going to talk about that. I'm going to give you, I'm going to write my law upon your heart. Ezekiel saying, I'm going to give you a heart of flesh. This is how God's dealing with it, is that he is showing how not just Pharaoh, but everybody has these hard hearts that have to be dealt with. And until we deal with them, we're not going to move. Like, we're not actually going to respond to Yahweh. And the way that he's dealing with it is he's saying, I'm going to replace your heart with this heart of flesh. I'm going to write my law upon your heart. And then that comes to its fruition in the person of Jesus, in that he's the one that brings it. He does all the things. He responds to Yahweh the way that we were called to. And he's the one that can actually do that. And then through him, we're able to have our heart renewed. That's what the Spirit does. It's only by the Spirit that we can actually have our hearts softened, that we can have our hard hearts replaced with a heart of flesh, or that Yahweh can write his instruction on our heart so that we know him personally and can respond to him. That's the only way that this is dealt with. And so Pharaoh is a first microcosm of the issue. And, or he's not even a first, but he's like the first major narrative microcosm of this hard heart issue. And we think that somehow Israel's outside of that, but the whole point's going to be that Israel's got the same exact problem. And all of humanity has this problem. And it's not until Jesus comes up on the scene and he's making this new covenant, this Jeremiah 31 new covenant, by giving up his very self for our sake, so that through him, our hearts can be renewed.